It.
Welcome. This is Liberty Southwest number 32. Today is November 12, 2014, and this week we are talking about the 2014 elections, the special election edition. Eric, you want to take it away?
So what do you guys think about the elections?
Not too surprising.
Yeah?
No.
A little bit, but it was little nice to see the refutation of the massive government conglomerate growing so much in the last 10 years. So I feel like this should have happened a couple of years ago. But
it seems like from what I've read and gathered that midterm elections, non-presidential elections, especially as you get into year six of a presidency, are typically pretty good for the opposing party. It's happened quite a few times before. They call it you can Google 6-year itch. But there's a lot of dissatisfaction with presidents typically 6 years into their term. So, the results were good for Republicans, but they really didn't do any, historically it's not unprecedented. It's pretty typical. One thing that I found kind of surprising, and I don't know if you guys noticed these maps, just how, at least from a U.S. congressional district perspective or House of Representatives perspective, how blue Minnesota is compared to almost any other state in the country.
You talk about the Congress elections, not the Senate. Okay. Yeah, that was kind of funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's by far the bluest state. I'll throw a link into the window here. You guys can take a look at it if you want. But and it was pretty competitive. There are a couple of districts. Like Stuart Mills came close to winning. He was within a couple of points of winning. There was a great deal of success throughout the country in both Senate and U.S. congressional races, with the exception of Minnesota, which is by far the bluest state in the country.
Well, that's why we are here.
Yep.
Well, I think the Republicans will end up gaining another two Senate seats here when these next special elections happen.
There are two runoffs. Is it what?
I think Alaska and
Louisiana.
Louisiana, or was it Mississippi? Louisiana, I think. Yeah, that sounds right.
I think it's Louisiana. Yeah. So it'll give them a 56.
Yeah, that's quite a gain.
Yeah,
I don't recall a swing this large in a while. But since 2000, 2002.
Yeah. So we have some clips. I'm going to play a clip that a lighthearted clip that goes over some of the more notable aspects of the midterm elections. We can talk about it. Roll it out.
Hey guys, welcome to SourceFed. Before we get into the real political news that actually matters, you might be interested to know that a governor,
Jay Nixon,
has uploaded a photo of himself voting to his Twitter in order to rally people to get out the vote. Little did he realize next to him was a very visible butt crack, and it was hilarious.
But what he didn't realize is that there are so many better butts he could have tweeted. Ergo, vis-a-vis concordantly, Iggy Azalea's, Kim Kardashian's between 2008 and 2010. Mine.
You got a sweet butt.
Thank you.
But anyway. Most of the midterm election results are in, my friends, and the Democrats are gasping for air in the deep waters of the red tide. As the GOP secured control of Congress and will sit, they red butts in the largest majority of seats since World War II.
The red flag now waves triumphantly on Capitol Hill as Republicans now control the House and the Senate, setting up a rough final 2 years for President Obama.
I imagine he was thinking, crap.
Many political pundits point out that these results are due to America's discontent with the current political climate and Mr. Obama himself.
There were some fun political firsties from the polls, which are worth chatting about around the political water cooler, which are small indications of our country moving forward in the realm of acceptance of all the flavors of the melting pot. For instance, Utah's Mia Love victoriously became the first African-American Republican woman and first Haitian-American to scoop up a seat in Congress. Congrats, girl. I love that you're adding some spice to that old white Republican goulash.
Delicious. West Virginia elected their first Latino to Congress, and Republican Alex Mooney and Republican Tim Scott from South Carolina became the first African-American senator to win a southern state since Reconstruction.
And he is now the first African-American in United States history to scream victoriously in both the Senate and the House.
Fun fact, the first black senator in U.S. history was Hiram Rose Revelle, and he was elected in 1870.
What?
In Mississippi.
What?
And he was a Republican.
Stroke!
Are you hurt?
Iowa elected their first lady to the Senate in Joni Ernst, and Republican Elise Stefanik provided an example to young women and men everywhere that if you put your mind to it, you can achieve your dreams early on in life, as she became the youngest woman ever elected to Congress at 30 years old.
I do believe that's even younger than you, Joe.
Don't say hurtful things, Will. Listen to your elders. Let's talk dank dope, y'all.
Marijuana legalization plastered many ballots around the country, and it seems the pro-weed tide is sweeping the nation, for the most part. Washington, D.C. voted to legalize the use of recreational marijuana, allowing a max of 6 plants at home with a 2-ounce max for personal puff.
Oregon passed a law that will allow 4 plants dedicated to recreational use, and Alaska residents also voted in favor of rec bud. And then there's Florida, which voted it's a no-go to medical marijuana use. Really, Florida? Come on. Just let the people ease their pain with the plant power.
That's your opinion, Joe.
That's true.
I don't like other people's opinions. They upset me. Guys, were there any interesting voting results in your area?
And
oh, I thought that was the end of it.
So what did you guys hear?
Dropped just 20 seconds ago.
Okay. So you heard most of it?
Yes.
I could roll back 20 seconds, or I don't...
You could try backing up a little bit. It was a fun little... The end of the clip's pretty good.
Let's roll it back.
It's probably our most entertaining clip of the night.
That is true. Here we go.
It's at home with a 2-ounce max for personal puff.
Oregon passed a law that will allow 4 plants dedicated to recreational use, and Alaska residents also voted in favor of rec bud. And then there's Florida, which voted it's a no-go to medical marijuana use. Really, Florida? Come on. Just let the people ease their pain with the plant power.
That's your opinion, Joe.
That's true.
I don't...
That's what you meant.
Did it again.
Oh, I did it again?
I think it was the same spot unless that was the end of the clip.
No, there's another 20 seconds, but there's nothing there.
Oh.
Oh, so you did hear it. So thoughts on that?
I don't know. It's so much information at once.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to stop it halfway. What do you think of Love?
I don't know. It's kind of
from Utah.
It's she from what I've heard. She's you know not even African American, a black lady who ran in a almost. I don't know what the demographics are in that district, but it's very white, and she ran a positive campaign. Did no negative, you know, there's no negative advertising whatsoever, and just wanted to, and she campaigned on fiscal conservatism and did pretty well. So that was kind of her strategy, and, you know, it's, I don't know, it's good for her, right?
Yeah.
Did she win, or did she just did well but came close to winning?
No, she won.
Oh, okay. Nice. And this is Utah, you said?
Yeah. Yep.
She's a Mormon.
I'll consult the Book of Knowledge here.
Book of Knowledge.
She won. It was kind of close. So 50.04% to 46.75. So it was a relatively close race.
Yeah, that's pretty close. Kind of like what Mark Dayton and Jeff Johnson, isn't it? Didn't Mark Dayton win by like 6%?
Yeah, he did.
Which is kind of close.
It was closer than I thought it would be, to be honest.
Yeah. I read newspapers saying Mark Dayton like beat Jeff Johnson, you know, by like a mile, you know, and it's like 6%. I'm like, well, that's pretty close. I mean, yeah, it's like that's not a mile.
I don't. Did you ever hear what the polls were?
What do you
coming
mean?
Into the election?
What do you mean?
Nope.
Here,
I think he was about. It ended up about what the polls said is what I, if I remember, but.
I don't know if you ever, Kirk. I don't know if you ever go to Real Clear Politics.
Nope.
But it's kind of a poll aggregator. So they take all available public polls. You can see each individual poll and then an average of the polls. And it was between 8 and 15%. So he actually, you know, as far as Johnson's concerned, you know, he outperformed a little bit. And Chelsea was dropped. Let's see here. Chelsea, you're back.
Thanks. No.
<Let's see here. laughs>
Now she's gone for good.
Is she gone? Or is she, oh, I thought I just saw a text saying that she was dropped.
Yeah.
Okay, we're back. While we're talking, Kirk, can you try and add her?
Yes.
So, I don't know. It's interesting when you talk about specifically Minnesota politics, how this election cycle, this midterm cycle,
Eric, I can't call her. You got to call her.
I've got to call her?
Yep.
Okay. Let's see. There she is. And
she said her internet was pretty bad today.
Oh.
Yeah, it must be that
the Minnesota snowstorm.
Yeah. Thanks to the elections results of Minnesota. Now it's continuously democratically run. I think that's the cause.
They're shutting it down.
Yep.
But it was kind of interesting how, you know, from a state house perspective, especially when you got outside the Twin Cities, Republicans did very well. When you got closer to the Twin Cities, even out in the second ring suburbs, like where I live, Edina, Plymouth, they didn't do very well. The races were close. But there's, you know, there's some opportunities there for them. I'm sure that'll be a point of discussion for, you know, for party leadership going forward to figure out why they are having a difficult time in those areas. And I've had conversations with activists in the area, and they asked me, because my stances are well known, and they asked me, you know, how to appeal to the younger demographic, you know, to get them to, you know, first of all, get out and vote. And I think Kirk, you and Lydia both mentioned this to me. A lot of Liberty people didn't vote at all this cycle, like yourself included. And, you know, and one of the things I mentioned when I was asked that question, I'm like, well, the demographics are changing when you're talking about, kind of the millennial set. What's important to them is the economy, digital privacy, civil liberties, and definitely not social conservatism that will turn them off altogether. And there's still, from a party leadership perspective, there's a lack of understanding that would, you know, messaging in that area would benefit them. And especially as you get into the core Minneapolis-St. Paul area, that's very much the case. As you get into the outer suburbs, that's the case to a lesser extent. It would probably do them well to understand that type of messaging would be beneficial. Let's see.
Did Chelsea, is she back?
I'm trying to add her.
You better try it again, Eric. Okay. But yeah, see, out of all the election cycles, this is probably the least amount I've paid attention to it, just from everything else going on. And so it's hard to say what was really promoted. I know when I was called by the Republican Party, it really turned me off because they were constantly talking about the Democrats' lack of Ebola.
Lack of Ebola?
Lack of Ebola fighting. Oh. And lack of the will to fight ISIS or something like that. And that
actually, from a national perspective, at least what pollsters and pundits have said, was a key to the Republican success on a national scale. Because they were trailing Democrats in a lot of key races up until about 2, 3, 4 weeks ago when they started hitting that message hard. So when you get messages like that, you know, these are polled out. You know, you have political operatives, strategists are saying, this is how we come back. But, you know, to people probably like you, Kirk, or myself, who may understand a bit more about that situation than the average person, they're like, you know, don't do that, right?
Yeah, I did not appreciate it. I wanted to talk to him and laugh at him for like, what what are you guys fearing? And it I don't know, but obviously it was a cold call recorded messaging, and I don't know, it just seemed very disingenuous. But
yeah, that type of call, I mean, it's done for a specific reason. It's effective, et cetera. So, as far as local, state, or national elections, either of you guys have any more thoughts on that?
Well, I was kind of surprised that Dave Bratt, I believe, from Virginia, he won.
Mm-hmm. So, I was going to bring him up, Danny. Good call. I thought he was going to win no matter what, really. But it was refreshing to see that he won. And I think it's going to be something to watch for the next 2 years. It was to defeat Eric Cantor, you know, I would think that he would still win. I mean, Virginia's a pretty strong conservative state, but do you have any map next to you guys? Did they lose the Senate? I think they lost the Senate seat.
Did who?
Virginia. The Republicans. Where? Let's see here. All right. Here's
Aaron,
one.
It has some maps.
What I found interesting was that I think the Libertarians Party actually took away votes from the Republican to make the Democrat win, or unless I'm thinking of another state. No, so
they looks like they retained the Democratic seat.
Yeah, and if you look at the votes, I think the Republican would have ran away with it without a Libertarian voter, but with the amount of Libertarian votes, Virginia gets some of the most Libertarian votes just because they're so I mean, that's where Patrick Henry was from. And I think Patrick Henry still thrives from a certain culture of Virginia still today. And I don't think that... yeah, how does this work right here? I don't know, maybe it changed. Gillespie has more votes now than the incumbent Warner.
Yeah, the Democrats, you won 49% to 48%. So 49.16 to 48.39. And like you're saying, Kirk, the Libertarian vote was not high, but it was substantial in that race. So 2.5.
I guess it wasn't as high as I thought it was. But the one I'm looking at right now on the internet says it doesn't show a winner. And it shows – I wonder if it changed to a runoff now, because all of a sudden right now the Ed Gillespie has 49.1 to 48.4 for the Democrat incumbent Mark Warner. So I wonder if that got updated all of a sudden just this afternoon. Yeah, they haven't called a winner on this whatever site I'm on here. What site am I on? Ballotpedia.org?
Mm-hmm.
So there might be a recount going on. Should be interesting. Then the Republicans would actually even take another seat, and the Democrats would lose a seat on that one.
That's a close race.
It's definitely in the margin of error, so where runoff could be called. So it's in 1%.
Yeah, it's 0.5 or 1%, depending, you know.
On the state,
yeah.
But I think for a national or a statewide election, I think it tends to be more like 1%. But
well, I see an article here, Ed Gillespie, this is on the 7th of November, concedes Virginia Senate race.
Yeah, I wonder if it, after the unofficial votes came in, that they had him actually ahead, and I wonder if his conceding affected it at all, but maybe not, I don't know. It's funny that they don't have a check mark next to his, what's his name's name, Warner.
Yeah. Does not look like it's still in question at all.
I must be at a bogus site.
Yeah, it could be.
Needs to be updated. But, I try calling Chelsea back now.
I am trying. All right.
But what do you, say? What made you bring up Brett, Danny?
It was kind of like the underdog story, you know. I mean, I'm sure Eric Cantor outspent Barrett by a lot of money trying to, you know, retain that seat, you know. But it's kind of, you know, it's kind of like another one of those, another of the David versus Goliath story. So it's kind of neat that, you know, he won the primary, and I guess it, you know, maybe it's not that surprising that he won the election, but you know, it's still this dude was no name, and then you know now he takes the House seat, so it's kind of neat. So Tea Partier, but
college professor, right?
Yeah, and he didn't have much money. It was all message, not the amount of money dumped into the campaign.
But Cantor got a nice, cushy lobbyist job. You know, seven.
No, figures. I think he's, isn't he like in like a investment banking now? Like vice chair or something?
Let's see where. I know it's a very, it's a well paying position.
Probably getting paid more than what he was doing at the House.
Yeah.
That's what all politicians end up doing. It's nothing too out of the ordinary.
I don't think he had any type of concern that he would lose that race either. Oh, here, it's a $3.4 million job on Wall Street.
Oh, it's nothing.
So, you know,
the joys of becoming a politician and leaving.
Worked out. It worked out okay for him.
I don't know. It just seems like all these candidates who got elected, they're either Tea Partiers or, you know, the same type of, you know, John McCain type of conservatives. There's really no one that is kind of, you know, about the free market and, you know, trying to limit laws and trying to you know, decrease laws, deregulate the U.S. I just didn't see, like, there was a lot of these type of candidates that got elected.
Well, from the House, you still have the Thomas Massey's and Justin Amash's who are voted in, but,
you know, no one knew.
What's that? No one knew, right? Yeah. Yeah. And then, yeah, there was like a McCain Jr. voted in, or Pete Hegseth type of individual, Cotton in Arkansas, who won pretty handily. But yeah, there wasn't really, if you're talking about from a liberty perspective, I can't think of anybody new this cycle. I don't know if you can, Kirk, or.
I don't know. Hopefully Brett will be. But.
Sure, that could.
I think Brett's probably the biggest one out of the mix, but.
Yeah, but that's just one individual.
It really, going through the results, really showed how hard it is to defeat an incumbent.
Yeah, what was it, over 90% won re-election?
Yeah, and that, how many, so for the Senate to actually change, that was actually a pretty big deal. What was their, let's see here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They actually switched.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's pretty strong. That's a repudiation against Obama if I've ever seen one. But
didn't you say that this was fairly typical, though, the six-year itch I think you mentioned earlier?
Yeah.
I don't know. I really thought that would have happened after 4 years, but I guess it was a presidential election.
And presidential elections, especially with Democrats, they turn out to vote at a much higher rate. So, in midterm elections, typically the Republican side has higher representation because Republican voters are more consistent than Democratic voters. Whereas if you have kind of a rock star presidential candidate or upper ticket candidate. You know, so governor or senator or whatever, that brings Democrats out, you know, at higher rates.
What do you think accounts for the six-year itch? I mean, do you think it's just that, you know, people voted for someone and then after they've been in for 6 years, they aren't seeing results like they had hoped? I mean, do you think that people are expecting more than they should, or do you think that politicians aren't capable of, you know, delivering on the promises that they hold to on their platform? Or, I mean, why do you think that we would consistently see this, regardless of whether it's a conservative or a Democrat novice?
Well, I will.
When in doubt,
consult the book of knowledge.
Well, I have a theory on it. I think that the culture of America really always wants change and quit the advance of the government. And nothing ever changes between no matter which political party is in power. And so after 6 years of it, of hoping and wishing that they would do what you really voted them in for, they get you know, they shun the next election. They don't really care, and that's just my personal viewpoint, but...
So, just a... I posted a wiki link to a wiki article from what Wikipedia says on this. The six-year itch, according to political scientists, is the pattern which takes place during a U.S. president's sixth year in office. This year is characterized by the nation's disgruntled attitude towards the president and his political party. During this time, there is a midterm election, and the party in power usually loses a significant number of seats in Congress. Prior to Reconstruction, the six-year itch saw the president's party gain seats in one house while losing seats in the other house. Presidents before Reconstruction did a little bit better, but so it seems to be, you know, a cyclical type of phenomenon that happens throughout, you know, at least the history of the United States.
I mean, I get that it's cyclical, and I get that, you know, people become upset when a political candidate, you know, promises all of these things, and then they get elected, and then 6 years later, you know, maybe it's not what the people envisioned it would be, or they're not seeing the changes that they had hoped for. But the fact that it happens regardless of which side of the fence, you know, the candidate is on, were the, you know, the person actually in office. I mean, and there's got to be something to that. I mean, do you think that, you know, people's expectations are out of whack, or do you think that, you know, the promises that are made during a campaign are out of whack? I mean, what do you think really contributes to that, or people just want change?
I think that I would say the promises of a campaign. So let's look at the last four examples. So in 1974, again, this is from Book of Knowledge, Wikipedia, Republican Richard Nixon was president when elections took place. He lost 48 seats in the House, lost 4 seats in the Senate. 1986, Ronald Reagan lost 5 seats in the House, 8 seats in the Senate. 2006, George W. Bush lost 30 seats in the House, 6 seats in the Senate. 2014, Barack Obama lost 13 seats in the House, 7 seats in the Senate. So my take on that would be it's almost a whiplash effect of that administration, presidential administration, not following through or poorly implementing their campaign talking points from, you know, from the election 6 years before. That's the way that I see it.
Yeah, and this is the first Democrat president since Truman. I mean, it didn't happen under Bill Clinton.
So, that's true. It did not happen under Bill Clinton.
Lucky,
but
though.
Republicans were strong in the House and Senate, really, in that midterm election and beforehand. So it was a little bit different.
The economic conditions of the 90s, as we all know, were kind of
pretty good.
Favorable
very
for
good.
Everyone.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, people weren't very disgruntled. So there weren't a lot of reasons for people to be demanding changes because things were going pretty well from an economic standpoint. So that could have, you know, contributed to the fact that that didn't happen under Clinton either. But I guess what I'm trying to wrap my brain around is, are we expecting too much from politicians, one? Does that lead to them making promises that are unrealistic? And is that, you know, partially, is that maybe the cause of this? You know, we're expecting too much, they're promising too much, and then, you know, we get, you know, disillusioned when all those things don't happen, so we go, well, we're going to, you know, here's the backlash, we're going to, you know, vote against your party to try and see get the change that we're looking for, even though that party won't do it either.
And I kind of agree with that. Yeah, we're expecting way too much because, you know, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, I mean, if you're a Democrat, you're going...
I lost. You back? Hello?
Hello? Well, hey. See, I kind of disagree a little
bit. I lost the last 20 seconds of audio.
Wars and things like that. And these are just like polarizing ideas that, you know, it just, you know, at the end of the day when these things happen, I think it just upsets so many people that, you know, oh, I don't like this anymore. Well, I'm going to vote for the other party. Well, this is what I'm seeing now. Well, you know, the Democrats lost. Now we got Republicans. But these Republicans are kind of like the John McCain Republicans. And, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll have Jeb Bush will be running president in 2016. Like George W. Bush said, he has a 50-50 chance. So if Jeb Bush runs, I mean, we'll probably have more wars and more spending. You know, things just keep on going over and over again. No changes. And, you know, people will get upset and, you know, the cycle continues. I don't know. That's kind of how I'm seeing it. I don't know how you guys are seeing it, but, you know, it's just never ending.
Well, let's talk about what people expect out of a president or Congress. What do people actually expect to happen by voting people in? And
Well, I think that, you know, in general, people, instead of having the solid foundation of what they expect of the government, I feel like the conversation is pushed forward by these really polarizing topics, these things that are very divisive. So someone will bring up a topic of abortion or gay marriage, and then people take those topics and then decide which side of the fence they're on, and then, you know, associate themselves with the corresponding party that has aligned themselves on whatever side of that issue, as opposed to people really sitting down and saying, what should the government be involved in and what should they not be involved in? I think that, you know, the topics get brought up not by the citizens as much so as maybe lobbyists or the political parties themselves. And I think if it were, you know, if it were the people saying these are the types of things that we want the government involved in and these are the things that we don't need their help with or we don't want their involvement in, that it would be an entirely different political landscape.
Yeah, I find it just striking that people have this inclination that they can go and vote to affect other individuals around them, on especially social issues, Chelsea, that you just brought up. And it just, it's what kind of has disgusted me over the whole system in the last 2 years of the whole process, where people have these expectations that they can go and elect the person they want to have elected, and it's going to fulfill their hopes and dreams somehow, where it really, your hopes and dreams are on you and not a government. How can a government come in and enact new laws or legislation or regulation to impact your neighbors that's going to make your life all of a sudden this pristine, your goal of happiness? And it's, and to me, so it's, I welcome this thought process of this six-year itch, we'll call it, to where people just stay home, don't vote, they don't see the change, it's a repudiation of whatever establishment is in place at the time. And it's, I think the more and more as time goes on, the more and more people lose interest in voting. What did Barack say? I haven't seen the totals of the vote. I don't know if we can look that up real quick, but I think it's like a third or 25% of the people that voted that were able to vote. And Obama was saying, oh, well, you know, I heard that this third of the population that voted, I hear you're, and then I also hear the other two-thirds of the, you know, population that doesn't vote. So what he's saying is, well, if I would have done more or done what I, you know, really came to do, then we wouldn't have lost all these seats. But to me, it's just ludicrous that we as Americans, the land of the free, home of liberty, can sit there and and say, well, I'm going to go vote this Republican. I'm going to go vote for this Democrat, and everything's going to be good because we're going to set the right law in motion. And it, to me, it's just such a falsity. It's such a a false pretense that it's America's culture that it was founded on liberty and freedom is so absent in people's minds that it, to me, is just disgusting. The whole, it makes me not even want to ever go vote again.
And Kirk, the turnout, Wiki, perhaps affected by the lack of a single key issue, nationwide voter turnout was just 36.4%. down from 40.9% in the 2010 midterms and the lowest since the 1942 elections, when 33.9% of voters turned out, though the election came during the middle of the World War. So it's one of the very lowest turnouts, and that could speak to what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so that mentality, I'm all for. I would love it if there was an election that took place and only 2% of the population came to vote. All the politicians and all the lobbyists and all the people governing, it'd be a lot higher then, but to keep their funding going and their programs going, but at the point of a gun to your neighbor. But I would, to me, I would love to see a 10% voting populace, to where it's like, oh, so that 10% gets to rule over the other 90%. Give me a break. And it was funny, you know, place that be is, you know, the common meme today is like, well, if you didn't go vote, then you deserve the government you get. And I might have even used that before in my life, but I find that whole meme disgusting nowadays.
Well, I think, you know, what's, to me, something to focus on is just, I don't know, have you guys ever read Stephen Covey at all?
Nope.
Seven Habits.
Seven Habits?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've...
So, like, he talked in this book about, like, one thing that I like to think about often is that, let's say you work really hard at successfully climbing the ladder. You have some sort of goal, and you work, you know, really hard climbing the ladder, and you climb all the way up to the top, but then you realize that the wall that you had, you know, leaned your ladder up against was the wrong wall. So yes, you were very successful at climbing each rung, but if you didn't set yourself up on the right wall, you're not going to get where you want to go. So before you start taking steps up that ladder, you have to really address, is this the right wall to be, you know, leaning my ladder up against? And so when I think about, you know, the elections, and I think about, you know, how we vote and what we vote on, I think we really need to be thinking about the walls on which we're placing our ladders, you know, and if they're the right ones, and if they're, you know, going to get us where we want to go. And if we see the six-year itch, you know, regardless of whether there's a Democrat or a Republican in office, it tells me maybe that we're not putting our ladders on the right wall.
Very well said. I agree. And I don't think the wall of the Republicans or the Democrats are the walls to be placing our ladder on. And I think that it's because of the lack of intellectual leadership in our country, that which is cause of that I blame primarily on the media, because they feed off of this. I mean, we hear about all the money that's spent on politics. Where do you think this money goes? It goes directly to the media. And these medias are the ones that do the polls. They keep the races tight. They force politicians to, all right, no matter if it's real or not, that the election is so close that you need to go out there and spend more money and raise more money. And I think that we just talked about the Koch brothers last. And it's there's a cause and effect. It's just feeding a system that doesn't need to be that way, and because of the lack of intellectual leadership, that we don't talk about the true roots of what we're doing to our country. And all that we see is government growing year after year, I was proud. I voted for George W. Bush in 2000, and I was super stoked about voting, you know, that he won, because I was fed up with the direction of the federal government that Bill Clinton enlarged just so much. And what did I see George W. Bush do? Government expounded leaps and bounds. And within the first year, I was one of his biggest critics. But I was still a staunch Republican at the time. But I was advocating him in public, advocating against him in public. And it, and from that point on, it really opened my eyes to the whole system and how it just grows that way, and it's never going to change. And that's why that process had to evolve within me personally. There wasn't any outside influence that I didn't hear any intellectual leadership before then, until Ron Paul, of preaching that independence, freedom, liberty mindset, that aspect in governance to, you know, we don't get that leadership to go and dive down the intellectual mind hole about it all, where we can go further study about it. And Ron Paul really has shed the light upon it all. And that's why I think he was the biggest, so staunchly fought against during the whole election process, and ignored by the media, and ignored during the primary systems, the debates. And it's, yeah, I just feel we're really lacking liberty-minded intellectual leadership out there that really would stoke that feeling of not going and voting for these people, for either party, not to set up the ladder on these walls of the Democrat or the Republican side. And
but I mean, even to have a ladder, you know, under the assumption that the political process is going to get you what you want. So, like, for me, the way that, you know, we can say, well, I vote, and then that's going to then lead to the outcomes that I'm looking for in my life and in my country. Or maybe we take other approaches. So, for example, if I don't like the way that, you know, Walmart conducts business, let's just say hypothetically, then I choose not to shop at Walmart, and instead I shop at their competitor. So I can effectively enact change, you know, with my everyday choices. I can vote every single day, you know, with my dollar. Or I can have, you know, conversations with my neighbors and community members, whatever types of communities those happen to be, and really spread the word of, you know, if we want to see something different, we can make those changes ourselves, and we don't have to rely on a government to govern over all of these areas of our lives and promise that they're going to make it better. Let's make it better ourselves, you know, just by participating in communities and in our country in certain ways. You know, are there more effective methods of change that we can implement as individuals and as community members that don't necessarily involve the political process?
I definitely agree with that. But there comes it we have to look at it from a federal sense and a state sense. And because I think what we're all talking about right now is all federal. But on the state level is when I view it as voting is actually very influential.
Well, I mean, voting with your dollar is not just confined to state borders. Neither is being a good, you know, community member. And community. So I don't really see a whole lot of borders to, you know, acting as a good community member or by voting with your dollar. I think that it can really transcend, you know, those theoretical or those physical borders that we've set up around the states and the country.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that the best way to vote is with your dollar or whatever monetary system's in place. But I've just done a lot of reflection over the last few weeks, and I've always thought about this global governance coming down our throats. I don't think they can actually pull it off. I think that they have to have competition of nation states. And within a nation, you have to have the competition of states. So I think that the more competition, the better. And by the United States of America having 50 states, let's say, which is official, but, you know, there's all the districts of Columbia, like, I guess we can get into later. But that competition is very necessary just for how the structure is set up, even for this global socialist movement is what I take it. But it's relied on to be able to counter the bad things that happen. And I think that it's imperative also to liberty. And we need to have that competition that people can experiment, that people can actually go and vote their local communities to, and then also all the way to the state legislature, to where that's, to me, is the most important voting. But on the federal national.
To what purpose, though? Hold on one second, Kirk. Before you go running away with this for a minute. So I just got to bring it back just to the beginning here. We're bringing this, you know, you're going back into the politics, but let's back this up a second and say, what goals are we trying to achieve and which goals are necessary for government intervention and which goals can be accomplished without government intervention? And let's really make that clear before we start putting our ladders anywhere.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
so what types of items are appropriate and necessary to be administered by the government as opposed to individuals coming together in a community setting or something of that nature? So voluntary cooperation versus having a government actually administer it. So, like, you know, infrastructure, schools, yes, things of that nature, it's national defense, right? But what about everything else? What about?
Yes, that's precisely what I'm talking about. I agree exactly what you're saying. It's but we all, as intellectuals in ourselves, come up with these ideas that think that would work for society around us, and you have to have that competition between communities and states to allow people to vote these actions in and let them fail and succeed at the same time, to where there's no indifference in failure to succeed, success in the measure, to where other communities and other states can pick up on that and utilize it themselves. And it can only happen from the local sense, from the people, from the local vote. It can't happen on voting in a national sense, because once you go to the federal state, it changes everything. It from a state, how a state is run, to a federal entity as the United States of America, it's such a vast difference that to affect everyone all at once is such a difference in what you're talking about, Chelsea, and how to implement and how to, is it right or wrong? I said things one last week where I said, I think all businesses should have to, pay for their own pollution control and integrate it into the direct cost of, a business, product that is the direct cost of producing that product. And that is an idea that I can't impose on people, that can only be implemented through, certain, vicinities, through jurisdictions, through, for me to make that actually work, it actually have to go through the federal government. It have to be a nationwide state regulation for it actually succeed. Because then once a business did that, you could move a business to that doesn't have to do with that, and they'd have that much cost profit ratio that they could undermine someone that actually paid for their own pollution control. So that's just my example. I've heard it from everyone from the liberty to the most socialist people, where we all come up with ideas that actually have to be enforced on the public. And there's the best measure for those to succeed is on the general localized area, to where you can vote it out after 2 to 4 years, where you can actually change things. Because once it goes to the federal, it never changes.
So, Kirk, I'm going to play probably the second and only clip, or the second clip and last clip, that kind of goes over what's been discussed over the last 20 or 25 minutes.
Few politicians in U.S. history have had the kind of impact that former Congressman Ron Paul has. And Dr. Paul joins us now, live from Texas, to talk about this year's midterms. Now, Dr. Paul, thank you for being here. I want to ask you first and foremost, you know, one of the untold storylines of this year will be the independent and libertarian candidates who have pulled pretty high and have fought to break through so many restrictions. So what are you seeing?
Well, I think it seems like this will be a very good year, better than it has been in the past, but we're still locked in on this mentality, you know, that people will think positively on these other options, but when it gets down to the wire, they say, oh, lesser of two evils, and they end up voting.
What is going on?
We're going to go ahead and pause. Danny.
Are you washing your hair?
Sorry, I thought I had that on mute.
What's that, Danny?
What were you doing over
Danny's
there?
Danny's washing his hair.
You're making a milkshake? You're making a milkshake over there,
no,
Danny?
I was washing my hands. replay that.
Ready to go?
I think we're ready.
Okay, we'll try that again.
People will think positively on these other options, but when it gets down to the wire, they say, oh, I got to vote for the lesser of two evils, and they end up voting that way. So we have to wait and see if there is a breakthrough, which rather disgusting. I mean, this whole idea that a good candidate that's rating well in the polls can't get in the debate, that's where the corruption really is. It's a monopoly of a one-party system. They claim it's two parties, but it's a monopoly of a one-party system, and they don't even allow a second option. And what do they do with our young people? They send them all around the world, getting involved in wars and telling other people how they have to have democratic elections. And then they have the elections, and we won't accept the people they elect. But here at home, we don't have true democracy. We have a monopoly of ideas that are controlled by leaders of two parties. And though they call it two parties, it's really a one philosophy.
Now, Dr. Paul, you were the Libertarian Party nominee in 1988 before you went back to the Republican Party and then made two presidential runs as a Republican candidate. Do you believe that in the coming decade we're going to see third-party candidates take national offices, maybe in the Congress, in Senate? What do you expect to see in terms of that, or do you think that's just still a long way off?
I think it's a long way off. I hope.
And I think I'll pause this for a second. I think that's another wall, like you're talking about, Chelsea, right? That's just not available.
Exactly. No.
Yeah, to, you know, people that, you know, probably as a group we deem to be well qualified and, you know, should be able to be competitive, but because of the current structure, they're not competitive and they won't be. And I will. With that,
yeah,
most
exactly.
Definitely.
Okay, I'll keep. Mm-hmm. I'll play the clips more.
Your suggestion is right, but they are very tenacious on clinging to power, and they're not. If a third party person gets anywhere along, they're going to do everything they can to stop that from happening. So I think it's a tough job. I think everybody should keep doing it, the people who are sick and tired of Republicans and Democrats. And according to the poll, about 80% of the people are sick and tired of Republicans and Democrats, yet they don't go and opt out for another decision. So I think it's either working in that arena or working to try to influence both parties. And I do a little bit of that because, you know, when I worked for, more transparency of the Federal Reserve, we got a lot of Democrats and Republicans to look into this and support that position. So there's two ways you can do it. You know, fight for competition, fight to get rid of the monopoly of the Republicans and Democrats, or you try to influence people with ideas and infiltrate both political parties because this is our problem right now is Republicans and Democrats both endorse Keynesian economics and they both endorse foreign policy interventionism and the wars overseas, and that's why we're in this mess today.
Now, Dr. Paul, marijuana legalization is on the ballot in three more states this election cycle, with Alaska, Oregon, and D.C. looking at recreational marijuana. So what do you see in terms of the new black market created by overregulation and taxation?
Well, I think this is what's waking up a lot of people, and this is another tool that's available. The marijuana issue has been taken over by individuals at the state level and essentially nullifying the federal law. So that is another way to attack the monopoly system in Washington, D.C., and there's going to be more of that.
And to pause this a little bit, all three of the initiatives on the ballot in Alaska and Oregon and Washington, D.C. actually passed.
And they were from the people, not politicians.
Right. The one that probably it's kind of interesting. It looks like the Washington D.C. initiative, since it's a district, and I think
let's talk about it after this.
I think you alluded to that.
I want to talk about this.
I thought you might be interested in that one. All right, I'll continue going here.
As time goes on, because I expect to see a time when there's economic chaos a lot worse than we had in 2009 and 10, with so much chaos, and people will have to resort to taking care of themselves and governing themselves at a local level. So I see some good signs there that the people are waking up. It's just that the political system is so hard to crack that.
And I think, Chelsea, that's exactly what you're talking about, right?
That's a big piece of it. I mean, one, the lack of, you know, competition, so neither party's, you know, really going to get us there. But, you know, a bigger piece of this, too, is understanding, you know, what role should government have? What should we reasonably expect from government? What types of goals and initiatives should government be involved in, and what should they not be involved in? So understanding, you know, if we want to make sure that, you know, I don't know, workplaces are less prejudice, or, you know, there's more equal rights around, you know, that might be something that we could maybe accomplish on our own. I don't know. You know, being better people, or if we don't appreciate the way, you know, a certain company acts, you know, then we don't support it. We don't work there and we don't buy their items, you know, just taking a different approach instead of running to the government to solve all of our problems or expect or hope that they will, really taking a second look at what sorts of goals and objectives we have in mind and saying, what can we do on our own, and what should be done with government?
Yep. So local participation and then voting with your dollars, basically. Two very good.
And then just identifying which goals are appropriate for, you know, which things can be accomplished most effectively via, you know, voting with your dollar, or, you know, community participation, or the government, and really, really having those clear before you start, you know, going out and trying to accomplish them using those different means.
Yeah, and it really goes into, there's always the principle of aggression, to where you're aggressive on someone, you feel the wrath of the law. And that's why the law is there, for national governance or a statewide governance, to enforce those things of aggression. But then the voting of the dollar is something that's totally excluded from that. That can throw society in certain directions. And so
I dropped a little bit of your audio there.
All right. Do I need to repeat? Hopefully not.
If you'd like to, you can. If you don't want to.
Do you think it totally got dropped? I'll just repeat it real quick. So it goes into that, we have to have law for aggressive behavior. But then for the non-aggressive behavior, we can, if without the regulation and the progressive positive law that's thrown down our face through the national law system, that we can actually enact change through just voting through our dollar, and to where the choices we make as individuals actually throw the culture of your area in a certain direction. It doesn't need to happen through a law, but through voting or through and voting a new legislator in office. Those issues are separate, but that
right, and it doesn't just have to
yeah.
be yeah. It doesn't have to, you know, there's voting with your dollar, but then there's also like volunteering time towards a cause that you believe in, you know, or establishing a charitable organization to try and, you know, decrease the level of homelessness in your area, or, you know, increase the level of literacy in your area. You know, there are all kinds of different ways that you can enact change in this world. And I think it's best if you look at these goals that you have in mind for what does a better world or a better country or a better community look like? What are the things that I want to see changed? What are the things that I want to see improved upon? What are the things I want to see go away? And really on a situation-by-situation basis, on each one of those topics, saying what would be the most effective method for making that happen? And instead of, you know, rushing to the government to solve these problems, we should look at would that be the most effective? And then not only looking at what are the intended consequences of maybe having government intervention in that area, but looking at what are some potential unintended consequences. Because we know that, you know, with every, you know, good intention that the, you know, when the government says, you know, here, we'd like to help secure people for later in life, provide social security. That sounds great, but what are some unintended consequences of, you know, having the government involved in, you know, in that type of situation? You know, so there's always going to be some unintended consequences that come with allowing the government to get involved in any sort of initiative. So we really have to, you know, weigh the benefits and drawbacks of whenever we even start to think that the government could help solve a problem.
Yes, Chelsea,
so what,
it's brilliant.
You know, so whatever, you know, so whatever situation we're talking about or whatever thing we're trying to achieve or change, we should really look at what would be the most effective, you know, way, you know, for us to approach this to get that solved or to make that change.
Well, it really goes back into what we talked about last week, the Koch brothers. They do everything legally bound by the government that is preceded by people voting in politicians to enact law, and that law gets placed in. And so what happens? You just play amongst the rules then. So they set up these PACs, committees, these nonprofits that all funnel money into organizing to promote more and more government involvement versus that it should be more of a community individual sense, voting for your with your dollar, voting with your time, you know. I'm having a tough time closing this argument, but it's, you see what I'm saying, that it's everything evolves. You can either evolve it through government or you can evolve it through individual freedom. And the freedom is the most fluid, liquid aspect that can change at whim of when things are determined to be harmful. Government is, it's very slow process. When something's determined to be harmful, then you have to go out there and vote new politicians in. Hopefully you can retract the law or enact new laws, and it's just a mucky system that never ends up changing anything. It just compounds upon itself and grows.
So, Kirk, should we roll through the rest of this clip and move towards wrap-up?
Yeah, I really want to talk about D.C.
D.C. too. All right.
All of a sudden, we're not going to see fairness in the elections and allowing people to get on the ballots.
But Dr. Ford, let me just reiterate the last part of that question there,
yeah.
Because yes, I agree with what you're saying in terms of what the states are doing. But at the same time, we do have an issue where in a lot of these states, there is an overregulation of marijuana. And the taxation is so high that, for instance, in Colorado, they're creating somewhat of a new black market for people who say, well, I can't afford to go through this the way the state is doing it. And it's still illegal for them to grow it themselves. So at what point do the states wake up, or do individuals wake up and say, you know what, we need true freedom here? Because right now, even with the laws that have been passed, there is not true freedom on this issue.
Right. And I think you're absolutely right on the point you're making. And that's exactly how they made marijuana illegal in 1937. They didn't just say marijuana is illegal. They put a horrendous tax on it, and that created the black market. Then they had to crack down on the black market. Immediately, if the regulations and taxes are too high, you're going to have a black market. Not in a year from now, you'll have a black market immediately. And I haven't followed that closely enough to know whether that's happening. But this is why you need people who will defend liberty in the purest form as possible. Because if they just say, well, we're going to take this away from the federal government and let the states do it, you have authoritarianism at the state level, too. And there's all sorts of people who get behind these kind of movements. You take an industry like the alcohol industry might be behind it because they don't want any competition with marijuana. So, yes, I think this is the case. And this is why you should argue the case for the purest case for liberty as possible, because there's a tendency for politicians, people in government, want to throw their weight around and use their power to overregulate no matter what the law says.
I appreciate what you said there about finding people who will defend liberty, you said, in the purest form possible. I want to talk to you quickly about ISIS. Now, this is not going to get a lot of discussion throughout the night, but in a lot of campaign ads around the country, we saw politicians who were talking about ISIS, and it was more of this politics of fear. Do you believe the country is shifting back toward this kind of warmongering policy that Americans, we kind of thought they were getting tired of even as recently as a year ago? Are we slipping back into that politics of fear?
Yeah, you know, a year ago, we were doing pretty well. We had built up a resistance against Obama, saying, well, it's time to take out Assad. And the Congress didn't go along with it because the people weren't anxious for it, and the thing fell down. But now, all of a sudden, because the whole foreign policy has backfired, and the radicals got hold of a lot of our weapons, they were able to show a lot of force in both Iraq and Syria, so therefore they can build up the fear. Just look at how did they get the American people to go along with a war against Saddam Hussein? It was built up fear, weapons of mass destruction. He's ready to kill us, you know, and that was able to do it. So yes, they use fear all the time. And once again, if they had a strict principle of saying that we have no business getting involved in the internal affairs of other nations, stay out of entangling alliances, don't be the policeman of the world. Besides, we're broken, we can't afford it, and besides, the foreign policy is a total failure. It always backfires on us, and the people who promote these wars have an agenda and a special interest involved. The people need the information, but they can't get it from the TV. It looks like the war propagandists are very, very powerful. And you put the government together and the national media and so much else, they usually sway the people by building all this fear. And I think that the only tool we have is to do our best with alternative type of communication. And in particular, I think the Internet is very helpful in that regard.
Yeah, and ISIS and Ebola were really used for that during this election cycle.
Did you just cut out?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Then no.
It sounded like you got cut out short. Sorry. So, what do you think will transpire in the next 2 years? With the Republicans gaining control of both houses?
Well, I've seen some interesting, actually, I think this is a Ron Paul view, is that we'll see a stronger foreign defense policy, specifically in the Middle East. And
so we'll follow the Wesley Clark statements of we're going to go to war with Syria.
Yep.
Next, maybe Saudi Arabia, Iran. Yep. Who else is left on the table?
That's pretty much it.
I think those are the last three, aren't they?
Yeah, and then that combined with loosening of global trade restrictions. So from an economic perspective, having control of both the House and Senate will be, you know, probably beneficial. You could see some corporate tax reductions and loosening of global trade regulation. So tough on the domestic Obama policy, good for, quote-unquote good, for foreign defense, and good for corporate and global trade.
Well, what are you talking about? What hampers our corporations from trading in the world?
Well, there are specifically corporate tax regulations. The corporate tax rates could very well be reduced over the next couple of years.
Right. Well, that would be good. Well, if the dollar keeps increasing, then that would probably have to happen because globally, our products we produce throughout the world with the higher dollar value
get more expensive.
Will be more expensive, so we'd have to offset through lower taxes.
Yeah, and the reason why the dollar is rising like it has is because of anticipation that QE is done, and
quotes, right? Quotes,
right? Right.
QE is done, yeah. In but quotes.
Yeah, but that's really why the dollar has gotten so much stronger over the last 6 months or so. Is, you know, it's the...
Well, I think it's all... Well, we don't need to get into it, I guess, right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a bunch of variables.
There always is.
So, well, how do you think this impacts Obama? What do you think Obama's going to do in the next 2 years with the Republican control of both houses?
I have no idea. I think gridlock is going to be. I mean, it's almost.
Well, what gridlock? I mean, it's just going to, bills are going to be passed, and Obama's either going to sign them or veto them. So it's really the Republicans are in a situation to, because a lot of these bills that the Republicans have been proclaiming that they've to help the economy, to help this and that, they've all, you know, they've passed these bills through Congress, through the Senate, but then they've fizzled out. They haven't gone to either the House, and they've never gone to Obama's desk. So, you know, with the three checks and balances, it's so a lot of these measures are going to be put forth to Obama. So it's on the Republicans to sit there and put the pressure on them to show that, all right, are you willing to, you know, do what's best for America, in our opinion? And if he's not, he's going to have to defend himself now. So,
specifically, what do you think is going to happen with health care reform?
Well, I know, what is it, 90%, 97% of all people running, Republicans voted or ran on the issue of repealing the Health Care Act, Obamacare. So
that's a real good
question. Obama's not going to – he's only going to veto it. There's no doubt about that. But I think they're going to have to play it out in a
a large percentage of the population is pretty openly against it as well.
Well, I think, yes. I think it's going to really harm me.
You know, I just had a meeting with an insurance agent last week, and she was saying that some group plans were going up as much as like 80%. 80% increases in their insurance costs as we start to see the true costs of this implementation. So do you think that despite public outrage that Obama would veto if it got that far?
Well, I think there'd have to be a replacement. Okay. Republicans would have to do a replacement of some sort to offset preconditions. I think preconditions was probably the biggest thing, because health insurance really was never insurance, it was prepaid healthcare. So
healthcare. And that's the biggest
pre-existing things just didn't fit in the model properly.
And I think with Obamacare, that's the biggest thing, is figuring out, I mean, when you're looking at health insurance, I think a lot of people would like to treat it as any other insurance, but you have...
It's not set up that way.
But you have a certain percentage of the population that could never
that
qualify.
It because it's unsustainable. It's like the Ponzi scheme of Social Security. A lot of people love it. A lot of people don't.
Well, it's not even that. That's not where the premium health insurance things are still unsustainable. That's not what I was going for here. But
I know.
When you look at health insurance, you have a segment of the population who has pre-existing conditions. They're sick. They really shouldn't. I mean, from an actuary perspective, they shouldn't be covered under insurance. I mean, there has to be another way to cover these people.
But the mindset of the populace has been put in that all you need is insurance and it's going to cover everything. That's just
right,
it's the mindset. It's not reality. It's the mindset.
But that's that's the thing that's not, I mean, I haven't observed as being, is being discussed is how do you, I mean, it's a small percentage, like 5 to 10% of people with pre-existing conditions who have chronic issues or whatever. I mean, these are people arguably that, I mean, everybody has a right to live. And, you know, and if you, you know, genetically or whatever, you know, for whatever reason you've been dealt a tough hand, how do you cover these people?
Yeah, but and you can't with how the system's set up already, though. I'm saying that it's unsustainable just for how it's set up. It cannot sustain itself. It's a false reality of how it's even set up today.
I don't disagree with that.
The system itself today is faulty. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had the issue of reform on the table to begin with.
Because of government law.
One thing that I thought was very interesting, and this kind of changed my viewpoint on it a little bit, was to understand that more and more science is coming out to suggest that some 60 to 70% of illnesses are as a result of life choices. So not exercising or not eating right, or, you know, smoking or drinking or what have you. So choices that people could be making differently. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that everyone that's sick, you know, made a bad decision. Some people do get dealt really horrible hands, and healthcare is extremely expensive and could cause people to become absolutely destitute. You know, it's a choice between destitution or death or both, which is really
what causes
sad.
The most the highest rate of bankruptcy of any endeavor when people aren't financially prepared and they run across life-threatening.
Yes, but don't you see that that's what health insurance has created in the mindset of people?
No, they don't
to disregard their choices in their lifestyle, the activities they do in life?
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that because most of these situations are, I mean, they're aberrant. They just pop up. You can't anticipate them. Like you get hit by a truck or when you're riding a bicycle or you're out and about. These are outlying type of situations.
Yeah, but that's the fact of life. That's just, those are the bad things that happen in life. They're accidents, and that's why you have insurance. But you can't have insurance when you go out there. No insurance company, if it was strictly insurance, they would dive deep into your lifestyle and want to know everything about you, and that's how you would actuary it out. But because
of
the laws and regulations, they can't do that, and they wrap everything together. Men are paying for women care, women are paying for men care, and it's all wrapped into one conglomerate, and that's how that's why I say it's the system that's set up in a false reality. It doesn't make sense in an insurance aspect. And all it is prepaid healthcare. So when people get sick, they expect to be treated. And that's the mindset that they have created around it. And it's no fault of the government alone from the laws and regulations they've enacted around it. And insurance companies are just left to deal with it. It's still profitable. They lobby Congress to sit there and enact laws that are still make the business viable, because the government has to have that still viable business. They don't want to destroy the healthcare industry.
But this is we're starting to, you know, get sidetracked here. I didn't mean to open up an entire can of worms. I just kind of, you know, if we bring it back to the election and the results of the election, I think I was just more curious of if you guys think that we're going to see some major changes in the original legislation revolving around healthcare.
No.
And so,
well, it's already been repealed how many times in the House?
It's not going to change.
So, yeah, I don't think it's going to change either. I think the only way it can change is if the Republicans pass in both houses a measure that replaces Obamacare with something else. And hopefully that something else will not be a mandated entity that forces, that limits people's freedoms, and that hopefully it just allows more competition to actually get to the roots of the high expenditures of the medical system. But
that's the tricky proposition, like what Chelsea's talking about. And insurance companies are focusing on this. They're focusing on wellness. So they have biometric screening. They, probably with whatever insurance policy you have, you can go in for a biometric screening. They'll take your vital measurements. If there's anything out of line, a coach will call you and help you, or you can call a coach, if you have high cholesterol, blood pressure, you know, whatever, and you can work through it, because it's always beneficial to the insurance company to do that. And so there are measures in place to do that, but the real difficult problem, and this is really being quote unquote solved through Medicaid, are the individuals who won't change. They won't change their health choices, so they're sicker. Then they go on Medicaid. And Medicaid is kind of a dual funding insurance policy where you have state and federal monies going into that policy to insure these individuals.
Yeah, and all that does though is increase the cost. The main problem of the health insurance is cost, the high cost. And the only reason that the high costs have gone skyrocketed is because of the government intervention. So it's impossible to fix, because government is only trying to fix it, and they can't fix it.
The government is a reflection of lobbyists.
They're so hands are tied in the whole process. But and it's impossible for the government to peel themselves away from the matter.
Well, they're heavily influenced by the lobby. That's who dictates most of that.
Yeah, and those are the bigger businesses stomping out other competition in the process. That only creates a higher and higher cost in the long term. But we're getting off topic. How about one quick other topic, if you don't mind?
Go for it. 5 minutes.
So,
that's it.
Weed, marijuana was passed in Washington, D.C., and it's not a state. So Congress has to enact if it's legal or not. Now that the Republicans hold office, in my opinion, the smartest thing the Republicans could do is go on and enact and allow it to happen and decriminalize it nationwide. It would be the move of limiting government and going back to liberty, freedom aspects, which is supposedly what the Republicans' platform is. But we all know that people vote out of fear and emotion, and the fear and emotion that a lot of people vote Republican is to stomp out weed in society. So Republicans are put in a hard place now with Washington, D.C. being passing that, and now they're in control of Washington, D.C. So what do you guys think is going to happen? What do you predict on that
with
measure?
Washington, D.C.?
Yep.
Are you talking about? I would guess that federal regulation will take precedence over that.
Well, it does everywhere still. I mean, they can. The federal government has done more marijuana raids throughout California, Colorado, Washington, than any other president previously, and it's happened under Obama. But so I don't think the federal government. I mean, I can go into you could stoke up the lone wolf, but I think the federal government requires an illegal drug trade for their systems that they have in place. So they do not want to make the most prevalent illegal drug out there illegal. So, or I mean legal. But
I still have an over-under of 10 years where it'll be completely legalized. Doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, but don't you think the Republicans can do themselves a huge favor towards joining up with the libertarians of the in the nation and
most Republicans
a promotion of liberty and freedom to and actually be the forefront of enacting this national legislation to enact that?
Once again, I think we're jumping into giving politicians too much credit. You know, there are party lines and there are baskets of supposed values that each party has, you know, and it is what it is. And when you have career politicians, they're concerned about their careers. And while, you know, us sitting here, we could say, well, wouldn't this do them some good? Well, they might be alienating a certain amount of their base. I think they'll end up doing what they think statistically will help them in the long run to get reelected. So,
but,
you know, it all depends on that those party handcuffs, you know, and what those party handcuffs allow them to do.
But the one thing that I think the Republicans are missing out here is that I think exactly what you're saying, that they will be hampered by it on their local state measure. But from an actual nationwide federal regulation, federal law, that's passed statewide would negate that harmful effects. And that, and it would be a move towards liberty. And the Republicans should be able to sit up front and argue with the liberty aspects about it of personal choice. And they're not harming
should be, could be, would be, but we don't see it. I don't see it.
I don't, yeah, I don't see it either. I'm just saying this is a. An opportunity laid at the Republicans' doorstep. You couldn't ask for a better setup for the Republicans to have the Washington, D.C., you know, the people vote to legalize it with overwhelming numbers. And then, and supposedly the, because Republicans have this bad mantra, but it goes back to exactly what Ron Paul said. It's really a one-party system. The two parties are just two walls on the same circular, semicircular wall, if you go back to Chelsea's analogy earlier, that really these two walls converge at once up top, that you think you're on a separate wall, and no, you're really on the top, or the same wall as you get closer to the top, and that the Republicans can set themselves up to dissuade and fight the mantra, that the stigma they have against them. And to actually be a strength towards liberty and freedom. And I don't see them doing it because they have to have that that separation of the two-party system and keep us all in the same two-party system. And I think that is probably why the Republicans will fall on their own sword just to keep that from happening. So,
an interesting thing that I think I've noticed is these, if you're going to talk about marijuana specifically, Kirk, these referendums have been ballot initiatives that are apolitical. So you have organizers who get a ballot initiative placed and then a vote's cast. So that's happened in Colorado. That's happened in Seattle. That's happened in Oregon. That's happened in Alaska. I'm not sure about Washington, D.C. So this is an apolitical endeavor. It's not, you know.
Yeah, and that's exactly the point. People want to live free. They want to have their own responsibility.
And it's happening.
And it's hampered by our government system.
Well, it's still happening.
Let's add that to the list, then, of the ways that we can enact change as citizens without expecting it of our politicians. I mean, so in addition to voting with our dollars and in addition to voluntary cooperation and you know, volunteering our time and our efforts, we can also, you know, add these items to the ballot without our politicians, you know, standing up there and trying to push them through. We can push them through.
That might be the way to do it. That's probably the best way to fight for liberty and freedom these days. It's away from the two-party system. It's nullification. Well, nullification of the federal law.
It's not even nullification. It's an apolitical way of dealing with issues.
Yeah.
It's not nullifying anything. In the context of what we're talking about here, that's what's been happening. And when I look at marijuana, to me, you look over the near to midterm, and that's just what's going to happen. And you know, the politicos or you know individuals who are involved with whatever interests that would like to see the status quo maintained, they're being circumvented by the people, and that's a pretty typical MO going forward.
And that to me is really exciting because that tells me that people aren't just sitting around and waiting for a politician to bring something to the forefront or being distracted by whatever platform is out there. Instead, people are taking initiative to say, look, this is what we want. Let's put it up to a vote. And that's just another way that we can, you know, take responsibility and take action to, you know, start enacting changes that we want to see in this country without relying on someone else to be doing it for us. And I think that that's really exciting.
And I think that's going to be the, you know, it's kind of a paradigm shift. It's decentralization of power rather than centralization of power. And I mean, that's facilitated by a bunch of different things, technology, various technologies, that type of thing. But you know, as far as what we're talking about here and what we'd like to see happen, I think that's a huge positive and will reap significant dividends going forward. So, I mean, we're all skeptical of the political process, I think, to a certain extent. But, you know, there are various tools that are becoming more and more utilized that really allow for more grassroots, individualized, voluntary solutions to, you know, take root. Which, I mean, if you're talking about, you know, specifically what Kirk was talking about, marijuana legalization, I think that's just the tip of the iceberg, and there's going to be more of that type of activity going on going forward.
I certainly hope so. That would be an exciting future, I think.
I definitely like it.
All right, Kirk, I think we've... Do you have anything else you'd like to cover, either Chelsea or Kirk?
I think I'm good.
Good?
Oh, there's many more things, but...
Yeah, don't ask him the question.
There's always next week.
There is.
So, hopefully we've had an exciting evening tonight. Gave you a little inspirational thoughts. This has been Liberty Southwest, podcast number 32, the special election edition.
Special election edition.
Have a good night.
And hopefully I can find what I'm looking for.
Adios.
Adios.